from tragedy to triumph.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I'm your host, Aaron Lane, a man in long-term recovery who has dreams and aspirations of doing big things. Now, I've been clean and sober since 2016, and I believe that everything that happened up to that point has shaped the man that I am today. Now, on a daily basis, we hear tragic stories, and our goal here is to present you with amazing success stories of people who have gone from tragedy to triumph. My guest today is the awesome Tracy Brumfield.
Thank you,
with
Mary.
Rise Up News. And Tracy, before we get into this amazing story of your use, transformation, and everything in between, why don't you give the listeners an idea of what you're all about?
Thanks, Aaron. Well, I started Rise Up News, which publishes a newspaper, RISE, which is an acronym for Re-Enter Into Society Empowered. And our newspaper is about stories of hope, help, humanity. And the thing that makes us unique is that we are distributed directly inside local county jail facilities. So we reach what has historically been considered the unreachable population, and we provide them with, again, what we hope is inspiration, but we also empower them with help. And the help comes in the form of a condensed local resource guide, which connects them to everything from basic needs existence, like shelter, food, clothing, but also employment opportunities, educational opportunities, advocacy, like legal aid, where you can find local NA and AA meetings. So a plethora of things that we think one, upon release, might find useful and helpful to returning back to the community empowered.
That was very eloquent and direct and to the point. And I think it's an amazing thing to hear that people like yourself, especially yourself, are providing these services to people while they're incarcerated. Things that, as we're going to get into, weren't necessarily provided to you. And there's a reason that you do this today. But people, would you agree that they have more access to assistance and help today, more so than they ever had?
Well, I think, in part, the answer to that is yes. Some facilities are doing a better job than others in terms of enrichment programming and connectivity to reentry resources. However, the directive of jails was never to be corrections or rehabilitation. They are detention centers.
Right.
They are to detain you pre-trial before you're sentenced. Here in Hamilton County, our facility is old, pretty antiquated. We have a locally funded county office of reentry. However, they are pretty overwhelmed with citizens returning back from state prison institutions and helping them integrate into the county more so than our local jail. Again, our local jail, for the vast majority of the population, is considered transient. They come in, they come out. But the average length of stay is 39 days. I don't know about you. If I hadn't shown up for my job for 39 days,
you wouldn't have it.
I probably wouldn't have it. My apartment, I would be in arrears on my rent or my car payment. So for those who went in with these kinds of resources, chances are they're going to have a lot of difficulty playing catch up to continue to maintain those resources. But we also have a vast majority of individuals who go in with nothing and have nothing to come out to. And as you had mentioned, I am in long-term recovery as well, but found myself at one point homeless and in need of social services, and found it very difficult to navigate our community resources on my own. And therefore, a condensed resource guide, particularly provided to those while they're incarcerated, not on the way out the door,
right?
You know, when they are
that way,
not
they have
thinking
time to
about,
actually look at it when
exactly.
They're released, or like, I just want to go.
That is exactly right. Correct. There are some pamphlets and things allowed or available in the property room, but
right.
Once just, you are changing and you are out and you're getting
all I can care about, like, whoa, I can smell my cologne on my clothes. Oh my gosh, do I have cigarettes in my
pretty
stuff?
Much?
I get what
will
you're
the cell phone still work?
You're and trying to approach them beforehand.
That is absolutely okay. Correct. And well, yeah, and again, that the resource guide is wrapped in articles and stories from peers and from those in the community who could provide just overall articles that might help you to relate. We also have in every issue what we call an interactive corner that is designed by a therapist who works with veterans with PTSD and substance use disorder.
Gotcha.
And it seeks to engage the individual in activities, whether it's coping techniques or anger management or thinking about your goals for the future. It is designed to engage the reader and to begin to thinking of these things, and then with the resource guide there to actually help them implement those ideas. That's what we think is unique about our publication, above and beyond the fact that we are distributed in the correctional facilities.
Okay, so now that I have a real understanding of what you're actively doing today and the amount of different, you know, areas that you're helping, and you're on the you're at ground zero. Really.
Absolutely.
But and I think it's a really beautiful thing. I've had a handful of people come in here that are actively working in those capacities in different areas, whether it's the hospital you're in, and we're for people who are incarcerated. You have people who, you know, at their first day in treatment, all of these different places, something that I have never really been good at. So I commend you for that. But
thank
to
you.
Get to there, we have to kind of rewind the clock a bit, because that's what you're doing now. And you said you're in long-term recovery.
Yeah.
I'm in long-term recovery. And I know you didn't grow up a little girl thinking, oh, I can't wait to run a newspaper for people who are currently incarcerated.
Right.
So where are you, so let's rewind the clock. Let's give an idea. Where are you from?
Sure. So I grew up in Amelia, Ohio.
It's kind of like the sticks, everybody.
Yeah, it's kind of sticks, but it's, you know, there's not a lot of diversity, mostly white, middle to upper class, and it was really, I think, kind of like living in a sheltered bubble of, not really understanding the struggles of others or any inner city issues. We kind of just kind of grew up in this little, environment where, it's expected that you go to college out of high school that kind of thing. And so, I did go to college out of high school and studied communications, which, trains you for nothing, but prepares you for a lot. So, my first jobs out of college were, interestingly enough, in publishing, printing, graphic design. And so I kind of had a good understanding of how publishing works and design. Now, it's come a long way since those days.
Right.
These were the days of,
where you literally would cut things, and copy.
The typesetting.
Cut and paste was a real thing. You're actually
cutting. The struggle was real.
Pasting it.
Yeah, we, had to burn films in order to burn the plates for printing presses. I mean, now everything's digital and four color. Doesn't matter if it's
you're
two
dating
color,
yourself,
four color.
By the way.
I am dating myself. I'm older for sure. And I think that in terms of addiction and the way that my addiction started is, towards the end of my college years, I began developing migraine headaches.
Oh my gosh, we have a lot. Okay.
You're like,
I know. Okay, so we're going to talk about this because I understand how bad migraines are.
Yeah.
I got them since second grade.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I didn't develop mine until I was about 23.
Shit.
I currently have a sister on disability because of them.
They're not a joke. My parents, I'm just going to throw this in here before you even go down this route. Like growing up, my mom got them. So I got them from her side of the family.
As did my dad.
And she understood them. So she would take care of me because I remember being super, all of it that comes with it, sensitivity to light. It happened all through high school, but second grade was the first time it happened. Through my high school years, my parents, my dad and my stepmom specifically, wouldn't really allow me to stay at home. They didn't think that I was really having a migraine. They didn't understand
it's subjective.
That. Yeah,
and
it is.
So if you can't see a migraine on an x-ray
just thought I was full of shit and that wasn't the case. Maybe sometimes. I'll give them that. But
right.
I can remember no, you got to go anyway. And I'd get to school and I would end up in the nurse's office because I was, violently ill and all of these things.
Yeah.
But my dad, who just unfortunately suffered a car accident back at the end of last year, is now getting headaches. And I've had a conversation with him. He said, son, I will never make fun of you for having a headache again.
Yeah.
So I just had to throw that in there. So yes, migraines are real, but you're suffering them 23 years old for the first time.
Yeah.
Do you know what brought them on? Just
I don't. I remember actually being little and my father getting them. And I mean, I'm the youngest of five kids, and it was, you know, be quiet. Dad has a headache.
Right.
Don't come running through the house. The, you know, he's got the lights out. Mm-hmm. And so I knew really early on my dad suffered with them.
Okay.
But I don't think I made any kind of relation to what he was going through and what I was feeling at 23 until a little later into it. My PCP recommended that I go to a specialist. At the time, there was a Cincinnati Headache Institute. I don't know if that's still in existence or not. But, you know, on my first visit there, you know, it's what they did. And so I was prescribed narcotic pain medication. I tried a multitude of preventative medications.
Which are terrible. Like, people don't get how bad these medications can suck, right?
Narcotics
are one of the only ones that seem to work.
Right. And, well, it made it so that I could function.
And still have a day, because you can't take work off all the time.
That is correct. I mean, this was my first jump into employment, right? Post-college.
Right.
And so, you know, I had gotten a job in business development for a printing company, and I couldn't, you can't take off work. And so that's what I used as a crutch, because the preventative medication never kept them at bay. They you know, they were still coming on as frequently as, you know, sometimes once or twice a week. And it was very debilitating. And so, you know, I don't know at what point I started even using the pain medication when I didn't have a headache. I think it was out of the fear of developing one during the day, that I would just take it automatically to keep it at bay. And
we have a lot in common.
Yeah. I mean, and it developed kind of like that, to where I was kind of taking them around the clock. Mm-hmm. And so I was running out, right? Because I was crying this many based on this many headaches you're having. And I kept diary of my diet. I mean, I went through so many hoops of trying to figure out if there was a catalyst for why they were coming on, or if there was something I was eating or doing. And there was just never found a rhyme or reason for why they existed. But when I turned 30, my mom was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. And she went really quickly. I mean, from the time she was diagnosed until the time she passed away, it was about 8 months. So my older siblings all had, you know, kids or, you know, careers. I had jobs, you know. I wasn't like I was in some deep career. So I took care of her, you know. I had stopped working and I was taking care of her full time. And
which, looking back, it would probably have been a blessing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I got to spend time with her that I'm really grateful now for.
At the time, it was probably really tough.
It was really tough. And the, you know, now looking back, what I will say, the unfortunate part was that there were copious amounts of narcotics available.
Because she
and this is when OxyCotton kind of hit the...
Early 2000s?
Well, it was 97, actually.
Yeah. Oh, so, wow. So, yeah, this is right.
Right when it came on. So yeah. She was, you know, prescribed, you know, OxyContin, Dilaudid, liquid morphine. There were just copious amounts of narcotics, plus, you know, still what I was getting prescribed from my doctor. So, I will you know, be the first one to say that, you know, it wasn't that I was particularly strong during this period, but that I remained relatively numb during that period.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
So suffice to say that my tolerance grew exponentially. And when my mom passed away in July of 97, you know, those copious amounts of narcotics were no longer available, but I had a tolerance that required copious amounts of narcotics.
Right. Yeah.
And so, so I really began, you know, heading towards the criminal activity, which was, you know, doctor shopping, buying from people I knew that had them, and just kind of, you know, doing that activity. I was still able to get jobs that were relatively well-paying.
Well, you're educated.
Well, you know, I had the skill set, you know, prior to my mom being sick. I had worked for different couple companies, and I was good at sales and business development. And so I was able to kind of maintain that habit financially for for quite a few years, actually, for a long time, more than one would think. But come 2009, I could no longer meet the demand.
For yours, okay. Well, because we are like on overdrive here, and I know because you've told your story a lot. I'm guessing you. I mean, you work in the jails. You talk to these girls. Said, look, yeah. I developed a pill addiction. Turned to buying on the streets, and this and that.
Yeah.
But I just want to rest there for a second, and when this thing kind of snowballed for you, right? So you started to get, you got prescribed pain medication, narcotics like Percocet or Vicodin, when you were 23, and that took off. For the next 7 years where you just took them all the time, would run out early.
Yeah.
And by the time you were 30, you move in with your mom. She was very sick, prescribed narcotics such as Oxycontin, Dilaudid, morphine. And you were not only taking your prescription, but taking hers.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And knowing what it's like, the only reference point that I have in about something like that and taking care of somebody that I loved, you know, at the age of 19, I took care of my grandma. She had dementia. And it got progressively worse. You know, I didn't have access to her medications or didn't understand them at the time. But I know how hard it is to see somebody that you love go through those things. And I know how pain medication will work on your receptors. Like, you didn't feel pain in a lot of ways. You were numb to what was going on around you.
Yeah.
And I know you kind of glazed over it. And I don't want to tell your story for you. But I think it's important for people who don't understand what addiction is like and how this thing had already snowballed into something else, but to also be in the midst of very painful, traumatic shit.
Oh, yeah.
And like, this is where you found your life. And, you know, you say you lost your mom in 97, that same year, 8 months after this all began. I mean, were you ever, just going to be real, did your mom ever run out of medication for herself?
No.
Okay.
No,
and I want to ask that as somebody who suffered or understood.
Oh, yeah. No. No.
She just had so many that was not.
That's correct.
Okay.
She was getting them from her PCP, from her oncologist. I mean, I would have never denied my mom the medication that she needed. So when I use the word copious, I mean there was additional medication.
Okay.
There was. More
this
than
this is the time of the pill mill. Anyway.
Absolutely, and there was more than she needed.
I just had popped in my head.
She wouldn't take the Oxycontin.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, she had taken Percocet for years, actually, for a back injury, and while she was dependent on them, she was never addicted to them. She never.
Right.
She didn't have that genetic mutation of the mu receptor,
like
didn't.
They talk about, right?
She didn't. So she just wanted her Percocet. She didn't want the Oxycontin or any of the other stuff that was being prescribed. So that's what I took.
There was just enough to go around. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't ask that to embarrass you or anything.
No, that's a valid question. I mean, that's a valid question. I mean, I think later on in my addiction, it would have been fair to say that there would have been a way to justify giving her less and so that I could take more. It just didn't happen to be the case during my mom's situation.
By the grace of God. And that's not something, like, I don't ever just harp in on somebody's pain to make it even more painful.
No, I think it's a fair question. Okay. I think it is a really fair question because I think for those of us who have experienced the progression of the disease to where we will do unconscionable things.
Gosh, I'm sure that's yet to come.
And we get there for sure, definitely. But at that time,
we can laugh about it today.
Yeah, we can laugh about it today. But at the time, my disease hadn't progressed to the point where, you know, that was an option or that was something that had even crossed my mind. It's just that the demand was far, far greater than her need.
Gotcha.
So.
So now, all right. So then now we can fast forward a bit back to where we were. I just wanted to ask that question.
No, that's a fair question.
And now you're 30, you said 30 years old?
I'm 30.
You're 30. And now all of a sudden you're cut off, really, because your mom has passed away.
That is absolutely
correct. So you went in that last bit of, even though it was a lot of medication, ran out, I don't know, a couple weeks maybe, if that. And immediately you can't go get a prescription. Did you get any of her prescriptions filled for her or anything after?
Oh, no.
Okay. So that was like just done. That was
so it was done. Yeah. And curious. So you're right. You're right on the nose where it probably lasted a couple weeks of what was left. And so, you know, I even sold like the Dilaudid. I never took the Dilaudid either.
Interesting.
I took the Oxycontin. I was afraid of like liquid morphine and Dilaudid. Like I didn't know enough, you know.
Right.
I was, my addiction just wasn't there to where I'd take whatever's available.
You were smart enough to know to sell them though too. You knew they had
value.
Oh,
hell yeah. I wasn't
stupid. Well, I think
it's
funny,
yeah,
right? Because okay. you went to college.
I'm
going to
throw them away.
You don't know. But
no,
you...
but I knew friends who, you know, later who would become my dealer. Who literally would be like, you know, I'll take that or whatever. So I don't even know if I sold them or gave them away, but I know that, you know, that I wasn't going to throw them in the trash, but but I wouldn't even take those things. So I would just stay with anything Oxy related.
Right.
You You're know,
like, you knew what this
I was
did
too
and
afraid
it
of morphine.
Isn't that crazy
yeah.
to think like, and it's essentially the same shit.
Yeah. Well,
can you
yeah.
really break it down?
Yeah.
It works on the, I mean, so
it's kind of crazy.
All your pills are gone, right?
So they're all gone. And I think that was really, honestly, Aaron, like the first realization that I had a problem.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Where it's like, wait a minute, I am really getting sick and I don't have enough of what I need. And that's where kind of my, if you will, for lack of a better term, criminal behavior
started coming
began, right. Which would be to illegally obtain.
Which is almost, and I don't think everybody will agree with me, but it's almost without your choice in the matter.
Oh,
it's
there's
like,
no
out of necessity.
Choice.
One, and I've had conversations with people, and they're like, look, you may have been addicted, but to turn to the life of crime was your choice. I'm like, dude, I was on autopilot.
Well,
all
absolutely.
I could think about was that stuff.
Yeah.
And now it was taken away from you.
Yeah.
And women actually, from what I've read, and I could be wrong about this too, but respond differently to withdrawal symptoms than men do because of the way that a female's body, the composition, but it affects you guys in a much more drastic way than men.
Right. Well,
and
that's
it can last longer.
And I didn't know that. Yeah. But what I know now of where addiction lives in the brain, I mean, the prefrontal cortex that has that, maybe I shouldn't. Behavior
right.
goes radio silent.
Yeah,
I mean, using becomes synonymous with survival. And
yes.
So there was no choice or rational thinking in the matter. It
no,
was
not at all.
The only thinking was, okay, now what do I do in order to get what I need?
Yeah. And to survive. Your
to
body,
survive.
Your body is over, like the conscious is overridden by the need, your perceived need. Of the medication.
Absolutely.
And for lack of a better, you actually do need it. That's the thing. People say, well, like, well, no, your body does
right.
in order to operate. You weren't even really getting high.
Oh, no. At this,
this
point,
was
yeah.
All,
it was
but
to not
your first
be sick.
Realization.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah, okay. I think that's really the first
well, it's important
realization.
To talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not that I don't think somewhere in the subconscious I knew that taking more than, let's say, a doctor prescribed was not a good thing. But it wasn't a realization, I think, in my conscious mind that I have a problem.
Right.
Until my thoughts centered, focused, and completely surrounded by how do I get another one and how do I take care of this?
So true.
And so
people don't know about that. And I always,
they don't.
Because remember, look, people who listen to this podcast, yes, are in recovery, but we've talked about before we even started that. A lot of my listeners have never struggled or they
right.
have a family one who does. And that is a very real thing that you just expressed. And I want to drill that home to people that may be their first episode listening and how addiction affects our brain and how it just changes us in that need.
Yeah.
And you didn't have the realization until it was gone. And also to be, you know, preoccupied with the getting it and, you know, everything. My days would revolve around it to the point of just, even early on, right? So you're talking, this is the first time you're experiencing this and we'll pick up, but I think it's important because there's still so much to come. There's still, like, if you would have known what you were in store for.
Oh, sure.
You'd be like, fuck this, I'm done. I'm
right.
stepping away. I need help.
Right.
But that's, you know.
One would think,
right?
But where, you know, again, where addiction lives in the midbrain, it becomes synonymous with survival. And the rational thoughts, if there are any, are how do I get this?
Right.
And what do I do? And, you know, let's even put aside for a moment the trauma of watching my mom die.
Yeah.
And where that grieving takes place, mm-hmm. you know, it is compartmentalized and it is, all right, let's do what we got to do. And so, you know, I juggled that amongst different doctors and those who were selling. You know, again, this is when the pill mills started to develop, mm-hmm. and there were people who were getting prescribed it, who were selling
everywhere.
It. And so, but, you know, again, it progressed to the point where it was not even financially viable to keep a roof over my head and to do all that I needed to do and still
and
be able to afford
your pills.
Yeah, a dollar a milligram
right.
on a pill, you know. And so
for people who don't know, that means $80 for 80 milligrams.
That's correct. Of which I was probably in need of 4 or 5 of those a day.
So you're talking $400 a day.
Yeah.
Anywhere from 360 to 400
right.
a day.
A day.
And how do you get that type of money? I'm curious.
Well,
in your situation, I'm just
and that's again, I think where a lot of the resentment of my family comes through. You know, a lot of them were pretty well off, and it was, you know, I need help paying my rent this month, or I need help, and that was real and that was true, but it was because I had spent my money on drugs, so it wasn't like
well,
I was.
I love you.
You're
like, yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm lying. It's just, you know.
You know, I really do need it for rent. It's just because I spent all my money on drugs. And, you know, I still think that there's, even to an extent, a lack of understanding where they're concerned. I'm the only one with addiction in my family, at least to substances. And I think that it was still my poor dad. He's in his 80s, and he's like, oh, you're just too smart to been addicted. It's like okay, it has intelligence has absolutely nothing
to do
with
it. If anything, it makes it more difficult to have a life of recovery.
Right, because the more intelligent you are as a person, the more intelligent and cunning your addiction is.
My dad always says, son, like there's this idea. He said, you need to approach this like one of those Dominican Republic baseball players. It's like, see the ball, hit the ball. That's what I do. I just see the ball and I hit the ball. Like if you could do that with your addiction, he said, you would have... made amazing strides right. early on. And that was a resentment of mine, too, though, is I'd see people that what I would feel are simple-minded, mm-hmm. like just simpletons, and they were getting it.
And
their
lives,
I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, this guy, like, all he does is dig holes for a living.
Right.
You know what I mean? And me, who has this high stress, this environment, and kids, and, you know, the 401k
right.
can't get it.
Right. It's funny because, you know, it is what they say is a simple program for complicated people.
Yeah.
Right. And I made it as complicated fucking possibly could. You know,
oh,
there was no rhyme or reason for maintaining this thing. And it got so much bigger than me and
yeah.
my ability to maintain. So.
So you said, so we can go back to this. So now you said, and you did this for a while. You were out in the streets. You were buying. You were spending
yeah.
a lot of money, getting
yeah.
family members to give you money.
Yeah.
I mean, what are some of the craziest things that you would resort to for cash in this period of time?
You know, I wish I had some great story to tell you about that. But honestly, at this juncture, it was just working.
Okay.
Making a decent living and safe. For all intents and purposes, on the outside functioning.
Gotcha.
But mostly relied on the generosity of family members
okay.
at this point.
Although that's fair.
It didn't, you know, it took a while, but at whatever point they did catch on. And, there was a mini intervention about, you know, going to
treatment.
To rehab and treatment. And so.
Was this before 2009?
No, this was in 2009.
Okay.
Was my first foray into treatment, and I went to the Center for Addiction for 30 days. I went through a medical detox, went through the program for 30 days, and everyone there was there for heroin.
Yeah, and you weren't there yet.
And I, you know.
And you're like, I'm not that.
I mean, I'm in my 40s, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just like, hey, what are you young kids? Why are you, all you young kids
you
have burn holes on your pants for?
2009, you said.
2009.
Is it what part of 2009?
I wish I could tell you.
Would it have been December? Was it towards the end of the year?
I honestly don't remember. I don't remember.
My first, you know, for people who listen out of state, the Center for Addiction Treatment is called the Cat House. It's in Cincinnati, Ohio. It is a short-term treatment center that centers around a medical detox. They now have a Suboxone clinic with contained therein. And it has helped a lot of people change. But for somebody's first foray into addiction treatment, including myself and a lot of other people, it's not enough time to get people to actually make some changes. If anything, and I'm not going to tell your story for you, but I learned a lot more about what I could do and around it than anything else. Plus, I went there for cocaine treatment, which was the silliest thing anyway, because it was out of my system in a couple of days, and I got introduced to other stuff. But you said you were there, same thing like me. I was surrounded by heroin addicts and junkies and all of this stuff. And I just had a bad couple of months. I still was not convinced I was anything close to that. Right. I had a great family. I had all these things.
Right. It's easy for us to judge in early recovery because it's like, oh, well, at least I'm not doing that.
Right.
Or, well, and that at least I'm not using the needle. And that's, it's our yets, right? Well, at least I haven't done that and end it with yet. You know, because that's the way it is in addiction.
Like, so we have a champion for this idea to not judge someone who suffers from an addiction.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea what they go through. But at the same time, we have ourselves judged other people who were worse addicts than us.
Yeah. And I've learned to use the word yet at the end of every sentence in terms of judging anyone.
And why do you do that?
I made it to every one of those judgments.
Mm.
Oh, at least I'm not doing heroin yet.
Gotcha.
At least I'm not an IV drug user yet. You know,
because those
at least I have a job and they, you know.
Yeah,
and they
lost
don't.
My house.
Yeah.
I had a situation early on where I was introduced to a 12-step program and taken there from the cat house, met some guys, a sponsor, you could say, and they sat me down and this guy, I'll never forget, his name was John. And John sat me down. He said, Aaron, you might as well pack up your car full of stuff, sell your house, find a man for your wife, and and just wreck the car into a wall. He said, because that's what's going to happen. You're going to lose this house. You're going to lose the wife, the kids, everything, if you continue to use.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, sure, bud. And guess what? I lost all of that.
Yeah.
So that whole idea of yet, it was yet to come. So now you went through treatment 2009. Your family encouraged you to go.
Yeah.
Did you give it an honest shot coming out?
Oh, I did. And I did. And because I felt that on fire with recovery thing, this is the first time I had been substance free.
Yeah. And you're like, I feel good.
I mean, since my 20s. I mean, so for 20 years.
You were in a cloud.
I was in a cloud. And this,
or not cloud, or a fog.
Well,
I was on cloud 9 something.
Yeah, right. Call it either or. But the reality was that I had been asleep for 20 years of my life. Or had been a zombie searching for them brains. You know?
You didn't go to treatment until you were how old now?
I was in my 40s. So I'll have to calculate back. Math is so I was in my 40s. And so everyone there was there in their early
20s. They were
20s.
Younger too. And you're like, oh my gosh. I can see that too.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of reasons that you would have to think that you were better at that time. But you were still on fire and for recovery in a sense because you got through the withdrawal there.
Yeah, and I wasn't waking up dope sick.
Right.
And I was, okay, now maybe I can really give an honest shot.
And you gave it, 30 days there, 30, 35?
30 days there, and I got out, and I really wanted to do all that they had encouraged us to do, which was to go to meetings and, stay connected.
You also still had those migraines.
Yeah. Well, not as bad. I had actually, over the course of growing up, my migraines actually reduced where other family members had ramped up in their older age.
Okay.
So, it had stopped becoming about migraines a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's just started about numbing probably other traumas and other things. And
I don't mean to laugh. I'm just like,
it's true.
It's so true, though.
You know, it is. It's just once you start taking them and using them in an addictive manner, it is more about the getting and the using and the effects than it ever is about analgesic, you know, release.
That's the excuse. That becomes the excuse. I mean, I remember being in Cat House and having a conversation with my counselor, and we were going through the DSM on medications and what I was allowed to take. Because if it's doctors prescribed, and I got out and I continued to take Fiorcet, which was helpful for me for migraines, until I wanted to take 10 of them at a time.
Right.
And then I would be drunk, but not drunk.
Right.
And had a vicious cycle of returning to the drug that I really wanted after taking those for so long. But I did that on and off for several years after my first treatment center, and it kept me out. And I had to learn very quick that I have to just deal with my migraines. Unfortunately, the best thing for me is to just deal with them.
Right.
And not because, and I'm definitely afraid of it today. I'm like, shit, if I end up taking a narcotic for that. And
in recovery, I remember, fast forward, I guess, you know, I don't know how, maybe a month or two after leaving Cat House, hanging out with my buddies from Cat House,
right,
because they were my soldiers
friends.
In arms, you know, like, hey, we've been through this
together.
Thing.
We're going to do it.
The whole deal. And early recovery and early recovery equals relapse, really, you know. And so as my friends begin to relapse and kind of fall off the grid, and I, you know, not long found myself just in relapse mode. Frankly, you can't undo 20 years of use in 30 days. And so I reached out to my friend, also named John. Curious, we'll talk later if it's the same one.
That's going to go a little closer. Because
okay.
You have such a
I'm speaking voice. I'm soft speaking, soft spoken. But I reached out to my buddy, also named John. We'll have to talk afterwards to see if it's the same one.
Okay.
Could be curious. But anyway, he's since gotten clean and helped so many guys. But anyway, I reached out to John and I was just like, man, because I know he had relapsed. I'm like, I've already gotten high on pills and I'm trying to find pills, but I can't find any.
Ooh,
and he's like, well, I can get you a dog.
Which is heroin.
He goes, it's the same thing. It's cheaper. And of course he wanted to entice me to do that because I'd buy him some. I'm like, look, I got money. I just don't. So he's like, come pick me up. So,
did you even have any second thoughts on when it came to that?
I did, but I was in such relapse mode
that it didn't matter.
You just
wanted relief.
I wanted relief.
I get that.
Yeah.
So, and for, I wonder why they called it dog.
Who knows?
I don't know. Either way, I'm gonna have to look that up. Why things are called, you know, what they are, or
right.
Horse,
boy or girl,
or boy or girl.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it's just, I know it's just code, but
right.
Yeah, for you to not, you were said as you're in relapse mode, he calls, or you call him.
Yeah.
Right?
I reached out
saying,
to him.
Okay, I need some pills. He says, all I can get is heroin.
Right.
And you're like, well, whatever.
He was
okay,
a great
fine.
Salesman.
Yeah.
He was like, look, it's
the same
thing.
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper. So I remember actually being really scared to use it, and I snorted it. We went and we got some, and we were at this weird house, which, you know, it wasn't really a shooting gallery or anything, but there were people using all over. And we went to this bedroom, this girl's bedroom, and, you know, he shot up and I snorted it. And I remember leaving and I'm almost wondering if he needed to pull over. I didn't know if I was going to throw up or what, but ultimately I got the relief that I was seeking and realized how incredibly cheaper it was than
right.
pills, and you got so much more. And so it wasn't long before this was became a regular thing with John and I. And
he was basically using you to get.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were the finance.
Oh, absolutely.
For all of this.
Yeah. And
oh, yeah. That's like the best type of relationship.
Oh,
when
yeah.
When it comes to drug use,
yeah.
You find the one that has the money, and you're like,
absolutely.
I know where to get the best. I need.
Yeah.
But the things you learn in this criminal enterprise of drug seeking behavior and the characters, the absolute characters that you meet, and there's some, like, there is no honor among thieves.
There really isn't.
And there it gets, because we have had a very similar exposure to what pain medication did. Like, mine was spurred from being, I had herniated and ruptured disc. I also had migraines. So I had two reasons. And then it went and spiraled out of control to where I had to take it all the time, and it gave me a different sense of relief. And then snowballed into heroin as well. And the first was, let me just snort this because it's going to give me, I was afraid. I was like, it's heroin. What are you talking about? I went through the DARE program, all that type of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then I did it and I thought, that cost me nothing, and I feel exactly the way I want to feel.
Right.
So,
exactly.
And good Lord.
And the economics of it played into how I went from snorting to becoming an intravenous drug user, which was, and I'm mimicking about less than a half inch. He was shooting this much, and then I'm mimicking about 3 inches, and that's how much I had to snort.
Right.
And the economics was, well, wait a minute.
Why?
You have to use a lot less to shoot, but I'm using this. So it makes more sense
right,
that I shoot. So another friend of mine who had also gone through the program with us kind of came onto the scene at some point. She was, this person who always had like the alcohol swabs and everything before she would shoot. And I brought you.
It's the preparation, too. People are really ate up about preparation.
Oh, well, we become addicted to the needle and to the whole ritual of
going
using.
And getting it and the feeling you get when you actually arrive. And I'm not glamorizing this or trying to bring back for either of us this kind of euphoric recall, but a lot of people don't discuss that to somebody that's
right. There's so many layers to
addiction. It's not just the drug.
That is correct. And it is often overlooked, even within the community of people who use. And later on with some of the women that I work with who lived, and survived through prostitution, who, even the street life becomes addictive, and then the getting of the drug addictive, and the manipulation of men becomes addictive, and the actual ritual of using and all that. And that's why the propagation of from news stories to anybody that covers heroin, the images we'll see are a syringe and a spoon and a tie-off. And it's like, what are we talking about? Often we're talking about the effects of heroin on lives, and that has nothing to do with these items and utensils. And it's like, can we not
show this?
Can we not show this? And can we stop using these images to further entrench the stigma of us being junkies?
I think it should be a law.
I agree.
I think they need to stop. Like every news article, I refuse to show things on my own page. And I did one time, actually. I shared the effects of withdrawal on a baby because a buddy of mine shared it, who owns a very large The Addict's Journal or Addictions or something like that. And I saw it, and I was like, that is so ugly. And it bothered me so bad. Yeah. And not that I like sharing, because this is stories of hope, but it's also that you have to pull
the reality. I mean, the tragedy is real.
Well, that's also, it's part of what I'm doing. Right. So I'm like, all right, we'll share both of them.
Right.
But I don't show pictures of people using drugs or I don't want to glamorize that.
No.
And it's not promoting a narrative shift.
Right.
It's promoting the same stuff and that there's never a solution.
That is correct. And to stay in solution-based conversations and articles in our paper is something that we are very conscientious of. And so, just suffice to say, I began to intravenously use the drug and wasn't very good at it, by the way.
Right, did you have to have someone show you at first?
Yeah. The problem was the first time I tried to do it on my own, I was very successful. And so
you were.
I was. And so that made it seem like it was easy. But really, over the years of being an intravenous drug user, I would spend hours in the bathroom trying to inject myself and, find
viable veins.
Because you destroyed
veins and...
Correct. And mine are just weird. Even when I go to get blood, it's hard to find. My veins are just super little and rolling.
Women actually experience that once again a lot more than men do. The people I would hang out with, I actually used to shoot dope with a girl, or a woman, who was much more progressed in her illness than I was. So much so that I would rarely have a problem injecting myself, but she would get to the point where she would muscle pop these things.
Yeah.
Where she would just inject it right into muscle.
Yeah.
And it would eventually, but she would develop abs. It was very, very, I forgot all about that.
It's so horrible, bad. Aaron. And that's, I mean, when I go back and I look at the times using, I mean, it's one of the most prevalent memories that I have, and one that certainly continues to deter me is the hours spent just trying to inject.
I have
inject.
Yet to talk about that on my show. All right. I have yet to delve into my own IV drug use. But this must be the junction for that, because it's very real.
It is.
And it's very ugly and it's very tragic.
Yeah.
And the concept that we can get from a prescription pain medication to injecting heroin or fentanyl into our bloodstream is insane.
Right.
And, you know, I've had other conversations where we talk about how we even got there as a society, how this was even available to begin with. My personal beliefs are that there's an evil component to it that is based out of greed. And it was promoted across the board because the availability of these medications in 1997 was so high all the way through 2009.
Right.
That there's no doubt in my mind that it was it's like a terrorist attack.
Right.
We've lost more people. I think the number was like, let me bear with me here because I'm sure.
Around
3,000 people we lost at September 11th. Like 2,977.
Right.
And in 2016, we lost 22 times that amount
of people through
drug overdose.
Yeah, 72,000, I think it was in 2017, which is more than all the Americans we lost in the Vietnam War combined.
And people aren't, like, that's the thing. People are very quick to talk about, you know, these tragic circumstances, like, which they are. And they're terrorist attacks. That's the September 11th, the Twin Towers falling was a foreign body attacking people on our soil and killing United States citizens.
Yes.
The opioid epidemic was a terrorist attack by our own citizens.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And we allowed it to happen. And I don't want to make this political or deviate, but it's a personal, and I have yet to talk about one of my personal beliefs, like in that sense, on one of these shows. But it needs to be said. Because there's some accountability that's happening. I have personal accountability. I put myself in those situations, but I would have never been there if I wasn't prescribed.
Right.
So.
And that's the thing, you know, actually in the article of the latest issue that you have there, issue 16, I talk about how, you know, there's still ignorance that proliferates our society about usage being a choice.
Right.
And so I say, you know, did I have a medical condition that I chose to have? You know, no. Did I choose to go to a doctor? Yes. Did I choose to trust his diagnosis? Yes.
Yes. Right.
Did I trust to take what he was prescribing me? Yes. Did I choose the effects long term of losing everything I've had and going to jail and going to prison because of it? No, I did not. And I think the statistics is 1 in 7 who are prescribed narcotic pain medication will become addicted.
Right.
Those who take it more than 30 days, the statistic goes to 1 in 3. Mm. So, you know, if you've got a kid that plays football or soccer and has an injury, or you yourself who think you are so far removed from this addiction or this lifestyle, you get a car wreck, literally anything can happen to anyone in terms of an injury, you're prescribed this medication, then I pray you're not 1 in 7.
Right.
And it is only through the fact that this disease doesn't discriminate, and we have seen those in more middle class or upper class echelons who are becoming addicted, or their children are becoming addicted, to where they now are starting to have empathy for what they have formerly seen as street junkies and whores and whatever they have judged us to be. And I'm hoping that there is a shift in the understanding that this is a disease of the brain where choice plays no part in it, and that there we can put it in remission, and it is treatable. However, it takes a treatment team. It takes a village, right?
In order for that to happen.
In order for to arrest this disease and to put it in remission. And, you know, I often say, you know, if I'd had a brain tumor, and that you could see on a CAT scan or an X-ray, I would have been treated vastly different.
Yeah, then
you know, then you know, if that tumor made me act out in socially and legally unacceptable ways, there would have been vastly different results and responses to my actions. But because I have the disease of addiction, I was deemed criminal, convict, felon, junkie, you know, right. All these things that for someone who came from the background that I had, who was set up to be successful in life by all definitions of the word.
Yeah.
Not just financially, but to live a life of contentment and purpose and all of that. This disease robbed me of all those opportunities. And that doesn't mean those opportunities hadn't presented themselves, that I was too blind to recognize them for what they were, and I certainly was incapacitated to follow through with them if I had.
Damn. That's a very real statement. It's a very, surely we're incapacitated. Because I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot of truth to that in my own life. I mean, you know, I was afforded opportunity beyond measure and had some fantastic things happening in my life. And I was brought to my knees by this. I mean, I was on a trajectory both financially and other ways. You know, I was peaking when it came to my career. I was making a godly amount of money for my age and didn't understand what was happening. Had no idea. I just knew that, I just know that if things were different, I mean, it's not that I clamor for that, but in some ways, you know, I still do get angry at the fact that this has been a part of my life,
yeah,
right? We've talked about before.
How
right.
different our lives would have been.
If this wasn't something we would have affected with.
Yeah.
I can still have gratitude that it is because of my life now, right. And I have this great perspective and get to help others in a spiritual program and all of that,
right.
A job that I love. But I didn't start really hating my job until it was centered around me getting high.
Yeah.
That's when I started to hate it. But I also hated everything else. I hated the woman I was married to. I hated having to be a dad so quickly. I hated that this or that. So that's a very real distinction. I'm glad that you brought that up because that's going to be something I'm going to have to write about because I think it's important to continue to express not only for maybe someone else, but for my own peace of mind and say, what are my real thoughts about this? What are my real frustrations, where do they lie? Do I still hold a resentment towards something, maybe even myself or the disease or whatever it is, maybe society or circumstances, just to be able to process it so that I can continue to move forward with what it is I have going on. So I'm just really glad you brought that up. 2009, couple months back, it didn't take long. Now you're grinding all the time. This is what your life revolves around very quickly. Went from snorting it to shooting heroin. And at some point, you get in trouble for it.
Yeah. Well, so it wasn't long. Again, like I said, I wasn't.
Because you went to the ADAPT program, which is Hamilton County Drug Court in 2010.
That's
so
correct.
So you're talking like less than a year.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk more about 6 months. So I was not a good intravenous drug user. And I'd actually had the flu and was sick and then incapacitated to go get heroin. And so by the time I was able to actually get up, I was then also so dope sick. It made it that much harder.
Right.
So I remember driving in March and the weather was bad and slightly snowing and I'm driving across town to meet my dope boy dealer and just sick as I could be. And I remember him making me wait for like forever. Oh, yeah. I mean, beyond more than just the, you know.
Right.
You know.
More so, but you can't, you don't have a choice.
But I don't have a choice.
I have to wait.
I had to wait. And so when he did arrive, it's probably the first time this asshole was generous and actually gave me a little more because of my weight. And, I mean, I couldn't wait to use. I had brought my, you know, my utensils needed with me. And so after I scored from him, I drove a little bit and parked into an apartment complex.
Right.
And began using. And so I got one in me, and I was just like, I had a lot of relief. And at the time, I had my sister living with me, and I didn't want to spend so much time in the bathroom. So I wanted to take the preparation part out of it. So I was getting another one ready for me, and then I was heading home, and then I was going to whatever. But then I had that other one ready, and you know what I wanted to do.
Yeah,
I was
like, well, already have it done. I need to go ahead and do it.
I need to do another one. So, you know, so I'm using, but I'm having a hard time hitting a vein, and I'm sitting there, and I'm so intent what I'm doing that I don't see a car pull in. I don't see it pull perpendicular to me. I certainly don't hear anybody getting out. What I do hear is a knock on my window, and there's a Cincinnati police officer, and I've got a syringe and a spoon on sitting in my hands, and I look up at him, and it was like, you know, the old cartoon characters, and he was like, yeah, yada yada yada, you know. So I was like, with my eyes, I'm like, this isn't, you know, maybe it's a security guard.
Right, maybe,
you know,
this isn't
maybe
really
it's
happening.
Just a rent-a-cop from like the complex. No,
like,
he's
you were completely aloof.
A full-on fucking Cincinnati cop. So
did he break the window? Right,
he didn't. But I was just, he was like, get out of the car. And I was like, wait a minute. And he's like, get out of the car. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, I'm gonna try and use one in front of him.
Right.
He's like, get out of the fucking car. So I unlocked the door, and he, like, physically removed me, but I didn't want him to get stuck with a needle either, so I kind of threw it over here, and he cuffs me and sets me down on the curb, and he starts going through the car, and he calls dispatch, and a lady cop shows up to search me and puts me in the car and takes me downtown. They're going to impound my car, do all this, and I will never forget this, Aaron. It was her looking in the rearview mirror at me and saying, you know, this could be the best thing that ever happened to you. And, of course, I'm thinking,
oh, yeah,
you're
right.
Full of fucking shit. This is not a good thing for anybody. But so I get booked in. So my first time in the Justice Center, my first time being arrested, I was 43. I think I was 43. I don't know.
Either way.
And once again, Aaron, I got to do the math.
No, it's fine. So you're
in my
40s. First time you're being booked into our
being
local
booked
jail.
In. Yeah, and it's humiliating, you know, strip search, the whole deal. And I stayed in holding. So I was OR'd out, open recognizance out. Like, I was processed and released, basically,
right,
for an arraignment for the next morning. So,
which is such a...
Right. But I remember just calling my friend, like, please come get me, and please bring some dope and a rig, you know. So she came and got me, and I used some dope, and next morning went to court, and I was given a pro bono attorney, and was offered basically drug court, which at that time I actually qualified for treatment in lieu of conviction.
Right.
So,
which means that you wouldn't get the felony drug possession
charge.
That's
correct.
If you completed treatment. And did you have an understanding of what was to entail at that
no,
point in time?
No, she said it's about, you know, 14 to 18 months minimum.
Right. Outpatient treatment.
Yeah.
And you're like, that sounds great.
Yeah, I can do this, right? So I was at first remanded to intensive outpatient, which is 4 nights a week for 3 hours a night, mm-hmm, from 6 to 9. Yeah,
which
on top
is
of having a job, you know. It's crazy. So I was doing that and kind of doing the deal. I remember my first probation violation was I had used cold medicine, and it came up for amphetamine. So I was given therapeutic incarceration. So just out of
so
cold medicine.
What do you mean by therapeutic incarceration?
So
I don't understand anything sounds therapeutic.
I know, right. So they call it TI, and in drug court, there's the term therapeutic incarceration, or TI, for those of you who've been through it. No. Which is you are thrown back in jail, mugshotted, processed in, everything like you had gotten a new charge. You spend the night or however long she deems necessary in the jail, and then you get out and you go back to your groups and you try again. So The second time I got a violation, I remember I had gotten my hand slammed in a door, and I had to go to the emergency room. I was prescribed narcotics. I had stitches, and it was, you know, I had a bone broken. And so during the time that you are on medication or anything, you're given what they consider like short-term medical leave.
Right.
So you don't have to attend groups. So I remember I had like a 7-day medical leave, went through that, saw my doctor for a follow-up. And he's like, you're going to need a little while longer. You know, of course, I wanted to continue taking the pain medication.
Well, yeah.
Of course I did. And so I did that, and I'll never forget. So I really didn't want to take more than I was prescribed. I didn't want to go back down that road. I really didn't. And I remember I smoked a little weed. I was in a lot of pain, and I was like, just maybe smoke a little weed. So the next day, I remember calling my counselor saying, hey, my doctor gave me another 7-day extension. So she's like, okay, well, but I'm going to need you to go drop today. And I was like, fuck. So I went and dropped, got in front of the judge, and she's like, well, I see here you were allowed to take the opiates, and that did come up positive, but I'm pretty sure your doctor didn't prescribe pot. So gavel hit, you're going to ADAPT. So ADAPT is, at the time, it was a 90-day residential inpatient treatment,
court ordered,
and at the time, almost everyone who went through ADAPT was remanded for another 90 days into Pathways, which was a
for women,
which was a transitional living place for women returning home from prison, but also where women coming out of ADAPT were sentenced to stay. So I was literally gone for 3.5 months with ADAPT and 3.5 months for Pathways. So I was gone for 7 months. So
unbelievable.
Yeah. So unbelievable. So you finish this, go back to, actually you start back in outpatient once you go to Pathways. You have to take the bus. You're not allowed to have a car there. You take the bus to and from your outpatient meetings. And so I did okay for a while. I did okay during those 6 months, 7 months while I was doing that. Then I got home, which I somehow managed to continue to pay my rent the 7 months I was gone. And then I wound up like, yeah, like this
you're
was
just the, revisiting
and,
it.
Yeah,
like,
these were the days of bath salts and
did you ever
K2.
Do bath salts?
Yeah, I did.
You know that's that came off the shelves very quickly.
Oh my gosh, it was crazy.
I mean, I never was fortunate enough to get a chance to try it, but I know a lot of people who did, and it was MDPV or methadrone, which was essentially methamphetamines.
Yeah, well, exactly. And so my friends who had done meth were like, dude, it's just like meth.
Right.
But they couldn't test for it in
right.
court.
And then same thing with when you say K2, which was like a synthetic weed.
Right.
And it made some people go crazy.
Oh,
a lot
yeah.
of people were doing it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was insane. So my buddies in drug court were doing it. So I tried it. And because I had really never been a speeder. I didn't really do speed and whatever. But I liked it. And we had, and my PO, I remember her sitting across from me at one point just going, I know you're on something. I don't know what it is, but I know you're on something. Because they couldn't a drug test for it. So she was perplexed, but she knew that I was not on the right path. So shout out to Abby. You knew what was going on, but she couldn't prove it.
Because you were so much different.
Right, you know, right. I was like out of my gourd, right? And I had lost a lot of weight and I was not acting myself. And, you know, I think I started to become addicted to it. And but I had messed up and it was stupid. I had found Suboxone at somebody's house. He was a good friend of mine, and it was outdated, but I took the bottle.
Mm.
And when I went to see my probation officer, it was in my pocket. And, like, I didn't even think about it. She's like, come in. I'm not going to arrest you. I just want to talk to you, which was bullshit. So they already had the gloves on when I came in. They wanted to check me, and sure as shit, it was in my pocket. And I'm like, but I haven't taken any. I'm not positive for it. So they drug tested me, threw me in the jail on a Friday. So I spent all weekend there. And that's pretty much when they'd had enough. Well, basically they sent me back to group, but I wouldn't admit to taking Suboxone because I didn't. But so they kept saying that I was unwilling to admit my use. And right. So therefore I wasn't progressing in my recovery. And it was really a bunch of bullshit. But anyway, I got violated again, and because I wasn't working my recovery program, and she gave me my felony, and basically that was the end of
the in lieu of treatment.
In lieu of treatment was gone. I was now a felon, and so
You know, that one defining. This is interesting, and I think it's an important segue, because that one hold over our head idea that, hey, if you
mess up,
you messed up and you have a chance to save yourself, I'm going to want you to do this program and you will not have a felony. And it all sounds great, because the fear that's surrounded with the fact that I can't get a job if I'm a felon, and I don't want to go to prison, and whatever the list is, especially, you know, possession of heroin or something like that. Like, this is not going to be good.
Yeah.
All I have to do is this program. But yet you go to the program and you recognize that there's a lot of things attached to that. Yeah. And that this is, for a lot of people, the motivating factor is to not have that felony.
Absolutely.
Myself included, until I finally recognized, like, it didn't even matter if I had the felony or not. I needed to get away from this for me.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter if I graduate, if I don't graduate. Like, why am I doing this?
Right.
Why am I here? Because I went through that program not only once, but twice. The first time, the catalyst was, I don't want a felony.
Right.
The second time was, I don't want to die.
Right.
And I should be in prison at this point in time from all the crazy shit I did the year prior. But you now, not that I am glad that I have them, but I've shifted my perspective to understand that it doesn't even matter. It's a piece of paper.
Right.
It really doesn't. If someone's willing to hire me, cool. They hired me here. So,
right. Well,
and that's not the same for everybody, though.
Yeah, but there are actually a lot of ancillary negatives that go along with having a felony in terms of getting housing or employment. But for me, you know, my biggest thing was, had I medication-assisted treatment, and Suboxone was available at that time, and I had tried it. In fact, it helped wean me off from
the
pills.
Actually, I was able to graduate the first time.
Right.
I just realized that I didn't even tell anybody that I was taking it because I was.
Yeah, they weren't testing for it, but I didn't know that. So when I was arrested for the heroin, I got on Suboxone, and Judge Burke had given me 90 days to get off of it before I started my IOP. So it was basically supposed to be used as a short-term detox. But in fact, I needed that higher level of care to continue on with me to be successful. Had I been allowed to be on Suboxone and buprenorphine during my drug court days, I have I know that I would have graduated. Yeah. I have no hesitation in saying that I would have graduated.
You would be resentful towards that.
I am, because they understood that it was evidence-based best practice back then. They understood.
That's why it was created?
That's why it was created. But it was a logistical and financial issue as to why it was not allowed in drug court at the time. And first of all, it was like, well, then it needs to be available to everybody. If we let some people on it, then everybody. But not everybody can afford it, and blah, blah, blah. I heard a bunch of rhetoric and bullshit around why it wasn't allowed. But what I knew and understood, that had I been allowed to stay on that medication during my treatment in lieu of, that I wouldn't be sitting here today without a felony conviction. Now,
and not only the felony conviction, but other things, I'm guessing.
But other things. But the other things that wound up happening because of it. And so, you know, so I had my felony, and I remember at this point, because of everything that had been happening, I had lost my apartment that I'd had for literally like 15 or 16 years. I lost, my car was repossessed. I lost everything. And the first time I violated in with a felony, which was not long into after having it, because you're basically dismissed from drug court. You get a probation officer. You still have your color and number. You got to call the hotline every day to see if you're up for to providing a urine sample. And
it's more stringent in a lot of ways, right? They just want you to kind of mess up.
Well, I guess there was a directive from Judge Burke that the first time I violate that I am to be put a holder on me, put me in jail. This time she made me wait about 8 or 10 days to be put on the docket. And then when I got in front of her, I remember my two sisters were the only ones in the gallery. I was the last one seen, and she sentenced me to the Ohio Department of Corrections, which is state prison, for 6 months. And today you won't see that happen. Today someone with a nonviolent drug possession charge
will
not go to state prison. But I was remanded to state prison. It was a shock because I had even written her a letter like, please give me a higher level of care. Please help me. I don't know what I need. I don't know why I keep failing, but it's not out of a desire to want to stay clean or to get through this program. So, but she didn't listen to that. And I guess she felt there was no higher level of care at the time for me that she could offer that would be available to me through her court. So I was remanded to state prison. And that was, looking back now in retrospect, Aaron, you know, it's definitely not an experience I would have traded for anything right now, because it gave me and afforded me a perspective of what's real.
Right. Now understanding it. But
yeah.
At the time,
you know, I felt I was truly being punished for being sick. I felt that I wasn't being heard. I felt, you know, scared. Just having the disease is scary enough. I felt very isolated and alone in this process. And I felt like if even the professionals around me don't believe in me and think I should just go to the state pen, then clearly why should I believe in myself? And so it was very self-deprecating, and it was humiliating, and it was more humiliating than even getting processed through jail. It's you become literally a number.
Yeah.
And and it
was
difficult.
I mean, that demoralizing feeling. Look, I avoided jail or prison. Not jail. I went to jail many times.
Right.
I have
avoided
like
prison.
27 mug shots that I can find, not counting all the other ones that for probation violations list goes on. But I've never been to prison.
Yeah,
and I'm grateful for that because I don't want to go to prison, and I know you didn't want to go, but yet you have to, and
you are sent
and processed in and become what in sense is like an animal.
Yeah, I mean, it was really strange. It's call it funny or whatever, but like I've always had this insatiable curiosity for the incarcerated population.
Okay.
Just in terms of the way they invent ways to communicate.
Oh my gosh, right.
The way they design ways to cook.
Have you seen that new Netflix show? I'm trying to think what it's about jail, about county jail, and they're talking through the toilets. They're they call it fishing.
Oh yeah.
They'll put letters on there and they can snake them through.
Yeah, of course.
Like, I wish I would have known that at the Justice Center because I would have done something like the ingenuity and the food. You're right. It's bred out of necessity and boredom. And we are very inventive, creative species.
That
I guess
is correct.
So I can get that. It's a very intriguing thing. And people, I know people are interested in it because there are shows that center around people who are incarcerated or locked up or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
So I get that you've had that it's intriguing to you, but to experience it firsthand.
Right. And so, you know, I've had this fascination my whole life with the incarcerated population for just those reasons that you described. You know, again, from the way they communicate and the way that they create inventions to cook or
there's a will, there's a way, right?
Where there's a will, there's a way. And there's always been that. When you put people in situations with very few resources, they will find creative ways to use those resources and to manipulate the environment around them. So going through it, I mean, I think once I had resigned myself to the fact that this was happening, I mean, I sat in county jail for 30 plus days before I rode out to the penitentiary. And so, you know, I talked to whoever I could who had been there and just kind of trying to understand what to expect.
Yeah,
but, you know, there's really nothing that can prepare you for what you experience. And, you know, I kind of took it all in as much as I could in terms of just, you know, listening more than I spoke and kind of just being aware of my surroundings and understanding how, you know, one's word is their greatest currency.
Yeah. When you're reduced to, when you have nothing, you're on, or like the fact, if you say I'm going to do something,
yeah,
you should definitely mean it.
Yeah. And the repercussions of disrespect,
right,
and things like that. So it's a place that really set up for me to be where I am today in terms of looking at the human condition without judgment.
Okay.
And to seeing people not as less than, but always equal to, but the struggles of others are not fodder for judgment, but opportunities for compassion. And so, but what I will say, though, is getting out, I was angry, but what really, I think, sent me over the edge is when I petitioned Judge Burke for driving privileges to job seek and to do those things.
Time.
Yeah. Once, if you have a drug charge in Ohio, at least back then, I don't know if the law has changed, but you would lose your driver's license automatically for a year.
You know, for a year. Wow. I remember, you know, when I went through it, she didn't do, like, in lieu of, she allowed me to, but a lot, you're right. I mean, if you gave you the felony, she'd immediately take it away.
Yeah, your driver's.
Which is like, why, I mean, why are you trying to make me fail? Like,
right.
Why can't, because you're not able to do her program or something. That was the impression, I'm sure you.
Right. Were. Well, and so I think what made her angry towards me was that I think she saw potential and she saw, you know, that I had had everything set up
right.
that for me. And yet
and
I
like,
was failing and maybe
yeah,
she saw
make
me
an
as,
example out of you.
Yeah. And I think
like, how dare you come to my courtroom? You have everything.
Right.
You should be not, you should get
right.
this. And I know you can.
Exactly.
And you know what? I think that's a conversation you ultimately should have. And maybe,
right.
you know,
oh, and I've tried to interview her a couple of times and I've asked, you know, and it was all call so-and-so and we'll set it up.
I've been
and then it's just
to,
never yeah. happened. And yeah, so, you know, but I can see that maybe she sees a lot of people who come in there who have really struggled the majority of their lives,
right.
and she has a level of compassion for them. But I think when it came to me, despite her wanting to be objective, that there was maybe a level of just frustration with when it came to me that I had everything I needed to succeed.
Yet. Right.
Maybe she saw me as defiant or arrogant.
And that's possible. I think she may have been at the time, though, in a lot of ways. I mean, because I know I find difficulties in it as well. And to accept the program for what it is and do what you're supposed to do just to get it behind you. Right.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know what? I'm always trying to figure out a way like you. You know, you did take the K2 and the bath salts, and we're going to take the Suboxone.
Right.
Like you still had this criminal thinking
right.
to your approach to your recovery,
right?
And still trying to find a way to get around some type of rule. And yes,
yeah.
that would be perceived as being rebellious.
Yes, rebellious.
So
arrogant,
maybe she was
defiant.
Like, "Look, she was doing for you what you couldn't. That you were and
yeah.
saved your life."
And it did. Ultimately, it did. Well.
And I understand the frustration.
Not immediately.
I'm just saying, well,
yeah,
not immediately.
Yeah, not immediately. It's certain because, you know, when I petitioned her for driving privileges and I was denied, yet I see people who've gotten multiple DUIs with damn breathalyzers on their steering
right, and
wheel.
They have, and,
and they can still
get a license plate that has that.
You know
right.
what I mean? It's like, but yet here I am, fresh out of prison and really wanting to integrate and to do the right thing.
You don't have a license.
And you're shutting me down from doing this legally. Well, fuck you. I'll just
right.
do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I became even more defiant. And So instead of embracing, I think, maybe some of the positive takeaways from being incarcerated, I clung to the negative and to the angry. And so now I wasn't accountable to her or to a drug test.
Nothing.
Or I wasn't on paper.
What are you going to do to me? Yeah. Oh, my gosh, I'm driving under suspension.
So pretty much.
Put me in prison.
Yeah, I'm not going to be in drug court. So so basically, fuck you and fuck the system. And, you know, and I went out and began using pretty quickly. And I went harder than ever. And my family at this point, I think from the same or similar perspective of throwing their hands up and we don't know what to do. And, you know, we can't enable you to continue using by letting you stay here. And I became homeless. And, you know, living in my car.
In 2013?
So it was 2013. That's correct.
Okay.
So it was around the winter time of 2013.
So right out of jail or out of prison in early 2000.
Oh, no, and that's not true. I would say it took a while to get there because I moved in with my partner and we lived with her grandmother for a while. And we got kicked out. We got kicked out like sometime in the... Let me think about this because I know when my clean date was. It was December 15th of 2014. So,
Your time. It's 4 years of. You know, you got caught in 2010, right?
Yeah.
And you went to adapt. You would end up doing inpatient. You had like 7.5 months of sobriety. Got back out. Started using other things.
Yeah.
Gotten yourself in trouble. Yeah. Kept doing, you know, this and that. Ended up in prison. Get out of prison. You don't have a license. You know, still angry at this, this, and that. You start using again, and it got even worse.
It did.
I mean, this is the thing. Like, I actually, when you were talking, I'm thinking, oh wow, she went to prison, and that was that. So, no, you got out of prison and went right back to what you were doing.
Pretty much.
And
pretty
it got
quickly.
Worse to and the it, point where you were homeless.
Yeah. So,
shit.
I got out in the spring or spring of 2013 and I became homeless in the winter of that year or right around, it was before Thanksgiving. So, and then lived in the car for probably 6 or 7 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then we actually managed to get an apartment. I got a job back with a company that I'd always kind of worked for on and off. They kind of stuck through me with me, my core shit and my jail shit.
And now you're living in your car
living
shit.
Living in my car shit. Oh, yeah. The boss would let me park the car around back at night. So at least I knew where I was safe, where I could find a place to park and sleep.
Good lookout, bud.
Good looking out. I mean, so I was working and actually, you know, still using, still living in the car. And it wasn't until December of 2014 that I got into recovery. So I got into recovery before we even had a house.
So what was the catalyst when you say this is when you got into recovery? What was that defining moment? You're like, I can't do this shit anymore.
Oh, there's a story that I've told quite a few times, and it was
not here.
So I'll share it with your listeners. I was panhandling. It was around Christmas time. I remember it was really, really cold. And I was out by Crossroads Church, out by Madison and Ridge.
Okay.
You know, a pretty affluent congregation.
Yes. Well, it's the Linder family. They're involved. But anyway.
So an affluent congregation during the holidays would think that there might be some giving cheer or some empathy. And I remember just being like super angry at these people that would drive by in cars that were worth more than some people's homes. And they would look straight ahead, not make eye contact. And I'm just sitting there and all I can really do is cry because of the state of where I'm at. And I did this for a little while. And there was a lady who pulled over in a minivan. She had kids in the car, and she didn't just roll her window down and give me something. She got out of her car and got in the back and handed me a fucking sweater. It was like, stay warm. You know, it's cold out here.
I can barely hear you. So she handed you a sweater.
Yeah.
It was cold out. This lady pulls up.
And she said, stay warm. It's cold out there. And it was with dignity and respect.
Like
and
you're a human being.
Like I was a fucking human being. And I wept beyond. And it was, for me, this gift from God, which I believe my higher power has given me gifts my whole life that I didn't see, didn't recognize, or wasn't able to accept. And this one was like, I use the analogy of, you know, it's like light beaming down on this big red, you know, box with a bow. You know, it was like, here is a gift of humanity.
Right.
And it literally brought me to my knees and changed my worldview of what it is to be a human being. And all the disdain and anger I had had for those rich people driving by turned into sorrow and compassion for them because they were so blind to suffering,
right,
the suffering of others. And that gift was like God telling me, this isn't your life and this isn't what I want for you. And within 2 weeks, I was in treatment. And it was I was spiritually fit before I was mentally or physically fit. And that gift and that the resonation of what it meant put my 2 feet one in front of the other towards treatment.
Got
it. And I've been clean ever since.
I mean, that's really profound, too. I mean, look, to everything you've talked about up to that point in your journey to this moment of clarity, to get a gift of humanity from someone, very simple perspective on what life is really about, to encourage you and turn to do the same for somebody else. It's like, yeah, someone showing you love, empathy, real humanity, and you're like, okay, that's like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
Because you didn't feel as though anybody cared in a lot of ways. And you also got to the point where it didn't seem, I don't think you liked yourself either.
No, and I think, you know.
And there's a lot of anger built up too and that type of stuff. And you know what? Very fair, because those are shitty things. Look, it depends on my perspective, right? I know that's a huge part of recovery, because there are things that I know I got a raw deal. There's right. No doubt in my mind, like just, you know, saying pleading no contest is something that I definitely would never have, because I didn't want to deal with it.
Right.
Stuff like that. Or, I mean, the list goes on. I mean, any type of probation violation. I'm like, I'm just trying. I was at work late. I'm sorry. Like, I couldn't leave, you know, like, and get in trouble for it. So for you to take that moment, it's interesting to say that God revealed himself to you, because as such, he's done for me in my own life and in my thing. And then to have the life that you today, that it all would have to be worth it,
yeah,
because of that gift. Because you said that's the moment.
Yeah.
So all that shit in prison, you say, I mean, right. And Judge Burke and this and that. Yes, it's all worth it so that you were able to have the gift of recovery you do today.
Yeah.
So now you take that and I guess things kind of snowball, right? So you get, yeah, so you go to treatment within two weeks,
yeah,
of that happening.
Within 2 weeks.
And then you get there, you get out of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And you continue to build upon this? Like, what's life like now?
Yeah.
This is 6 years, right?
Yeah, it'll be 5 years this year. So, you know, I continued to do what I needed to do and got a place to live. God just kept blessing me with opportunity. And in the fall of 2016. So I got a year and some under my belt by the grace of God.
Right.
And the help of medication and intense therapy and treatment. I began volunteering in the Justice Center to help women who were struggling in addiction. And I actually went to Cat House and became I became an employee of Cat House, which was interesting. I worked third shift.
Full circle.
Right. Yeah, I worked for Cat House third shift as a patient aide on the men's detox unit, and I had gotten off one morning at 7:30 in the morning, and I had to go volunteer in the jail in a couple hours, and God blessed me again with the seed of an idea for this newspaper. It just popped into my head, and I walked across the room and got a notebook, and 40 minutes later, I looked up, and I had what could be the first issue of a newspaper for the jail. I went in that day, and with the lady I was volunteering with, she runs a ministry called Art for All People. Her name's Sarah Hillman. And I said, Sarah, I have this idea for the jail. What do you think? And she was like, I think it's an amazing idea, and I think I know where you can get funding for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, really? And she said, there's an organization called People's Liberty. They grant to people and not nonprofits or organizations. Right. They grant people in their ideas. And you better hurry. I think there's only 10 days left to apply. At the time, I didn't know that People's Liberty offered all kinds of different grants. This is the last year for People's Liberty. They were a five-year project from 2015 to 2020 to give grants to people. So I went on their website that day, and I looked at the application, and they made it very accessible for the layperson. It was four words. Who are you? What's your idea? Why is it needed? And why is now the right time? And so I began the application process, and in the interim, asked the head of jail services at the time, Major Charmaine McGuffey, who was really creating programming inside the jail to help people with substance use disorder, and asked her what she thought, and she thought it was a good idea, and said that, you know, I said, if I can get it funded, would you pilot it in this facility? And she said, I don't see why not, you know? And so I filled out the application, and within a week and a half, I found out I was a finalist. Finalists go for interviews. I interviewed, and within about 8 or 10 days after that, I found out that I was awarded a $100,000 grant.
Oh my God!
To launch Rise Newspaper. What?
Right.
I mean, my mind was just blown off the top of my head. I was astounded. I was like, I can't wait to quit my two jobs, because I was working at Cat plus still working at the other place and volunteering. And the thing with it's a one-year sabbatical fellowship, and you quit your jobs and you focus solely on the idea. You are paid out of that $100,000 plus whatever additional to launch your project. And I told them in the application, some of the best advice I got is before submitting, you can do a one-on-one with one of their program directors to kind of bounce your idea off them, and they give you feedback. And I met with Aurore Fournier, and she said, because my biggest thing was, would it be eligible? Because it has to deal with the jail, and maybe they wouldn't do that. And when she told me that it's absolutely eligible and something that they would, you know, potentially fund, I mean, I walked out of there feeling like, you know, we're going to win this thing. But the best advice I got from her was, under the who are you part, don't regurgitate your resume. You know, tell us who you are. And so I did, and I told them I was in recovery from heroin addiction, that I'd been to jail and prison, and, you know, seeing from both sides systemic gaps in reentry, and particularly at the local level, why I thought the idea was important, et cetera. And so from the time I had the idea until the time I had the grant was about 5 weeks, and that is God. And to me, there is... I no longer use the word coincidence in my life, because
right, right, no, because this absolutely not coincidence. It's just a part of the design of what your life
just
can,
want
right.
Exactly why you're here, sitting and doing what you're doing.
I told people I don't believe in coincidence. Yeah. I do not. I just don't.
Yeah, it's no longer a part of my vocabulary, honestly, Aaron. It's this is, and everything that's happened since has been such a blessing, and the right people, the resources, the funding has all come when it was needed. And, you know, so for a year from April 17th to April 18th, this was my fellowship year. Got and you. In April of 2018, we became a nonprofit organization. And again, by the grace of God and the fine people at People's Liberty and the Carol Ann and Ralph E. Hale Jr. U.S. Bank Foundation, we're funded for another year. However, now we're, you know, past April 19, and we are, you know, we are looking for funds. I mean, like we spoke earlier before the program, I'm not a grant writer. Right. I'm not this, I'm not that, but we certainly are trying to write grants for this space and why what we're doing is so important. The next iteration, I hope, is Rise Youth for the juvenile detention centers. Mm-hmm. To hopefully to get change that school to prison pipeline and to get kids empower them in voice and yeah. inclusion in the community before they so arrive
before they
in
become
adult,
in that you know we talk about
the adult system yeah
right let them be the ones that succeed and that's yeah. because of that recovery high schools are going to be popping
right.
up more too
right.
that's a real thing.
Right.
I think that's a genius idea. I think that's something that really needs to be, and I would love to be involved in any way that you
oh,
see
I would
fit
love you to.
Because,
we're seeking funding right now. We're writing grants. We're hoping people will contribute either individually or, you know, talk to the organizations that they work for or, you know, talk to their employers about helping us, people getting out a dollar and going to our website and giving it to us. I mean, it's you know, as our tagline is, the movement begins, and it will take a movement from within and without of the recovery community.
Right.
Of those who, I say, if you can spare it, share it, whether it's with our organization or another boots on the ground organization that are grassroots and working on the front lines and at ground zero to help support us.
I don't want my children to go through I don't want them to go through this at all. They've gone through it enough, and I believe that we're currently putting a Band-Aid on the rupture of our age group
yeah.
here
yeah.
with how addiction has affected us and the opioids themselves. But my hope is that my children never have to imbibe any of that.
I know. I mean,
because they've
friend.
Seen enough. And there's going to be a lot of kids that don't have their parents. We have
right.
things we don't talk about, like kids
right.
are, and that's exactly why I believe we're going to win that. I believe we will. And it'll be a perspective shift. Well, yeah, I mean, because this would be all in vain if it was.
Right. Well, and we have a whole new generation of kids that are put into the foster care system
yeah.
who are going through and who are angry and traumatized
yeah.
and may, in fact, wind up in juvenile detention centers.
Mm-hmm.
And parents who, for all intents and purposes, are just wonderful and great people and great parents, but have been afflicted with a disease that takes them away from that, the most loving part of themselves, and puts their attention on the most insidious disease that I've come across in my life. And I've watched my mom die of cancer, and you know, I wouldn't wish addiction on even the most heinous of individuals in this world, because it will take everything good in you and distort it. I believe we can reclaim those good things in us, because I don't think they leave us. I think every time we deny a visit with our children because we're out using, or we deny ourselves the ability to get a good job because we're out focusing on using, I don't think we lose those parts of ourselves. I think they just lay dormant until we can put this disease in remission.
Mm. I like that. Tracy, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your story and the reason that you do what you do and your path to get there. I think it's commendable in a thousand ways. But you're living proof that recovery works.
It does work.
Triumph in the fact that you have taken some really ugly things and made them into something beautiful and give of yourself in such a way that's not easy at all.
No.
For you to express when we started this, what goes into the services that you're providing, I know that has to come from somewhere. I know that you have to put these things together and someone has to show up, which is you. But I think it's really cool, and it allows you to have the life that you do today. Now,
I'm very blessed today.
So what's the website?
So it's www.riseupnews.org.
And you can also be found on like Facebook.
Yeah, we're across all platforms on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. If I had the young millennials that I love that work for me, Salvador Mendoza is our multimedia coordinator, and Emma Jenkins, our editor-in-chief. They are amazing. I'm too old. I'm not even on Twitter, but they keep us connected on that social realm. Which is amazing, and people can find us through all platforms. And, you know, we encourage them to read past issues, feature stories, take a look at the resources that we offer, the resource guide online, if you, in fact, are looking for treatment centers or basic needs assistance. And, of course, always, if you can spare it, share it. We are beyond grateful for any contribution. At the very least of which is to tell other people about our organization. We appreciate those who share and speak about us, and we hope that Rise Youth gets the funding it needs to launch. We think it's needed, and I will definitely call upon you, Aaron. I'm sure you can be an amazing.
I mean, I'll be a voice to make sure. And this is a nice way to get that out too.
It.
That's going to be no, absolutely. I'm thankful that you came in, and I usually ask leave it on this. Like, if for the person still struggling, what would you say to them?
I'd say there's hope that this disease can be put in remission. Treatment is hard. I say recovery is an upward battle, but addiction is a downward spiral. Mm. And to rise up means a big fight ahead of you, but the good news is you are absolutely not alone, and you don't have to do it by yourself.
There you go. Tracy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.
You guys can find them online, Rise Up. They also are on Facebook, all platforms. This episode will be released very soon. I'll go ahead and provide all the links in my post. And
fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, so
thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome, dear.
I really appreciate it.
It was it's a lot of fun. It's an important thing, and I'm always grateful to meet new people and
likewise
see why people are doing what they do, especially when I believe in it so much and I can see sense the need for that. So that's going to be awesome, everybody. It's Aaron Lane, your host of Tragedy to Triumph. We're going to cut this one off, and remember, and as always, do big things.